From the land to Grand University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 19th day of April, 2023. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason in Washington, D.C. this week with the National Association of Farm Broadcasting. Today, we'll talk with the folks that lobby on behalf of the RFS and the biofuels industry, including corn-based ethanol. We'll discuss the transition to electric vehicles and how U.S. EPA has been handling its new powers as it's related to the RVOs, the Renewable Volume Obligation, or the amount of ethanol that's mixed into the nation's gasoline supply. And then we'll take up more as it's related to the electric vehicle. There is a push by the auto industry to take AM radio out of the dashboard. I asked the U.S. Secretary of Transportation yesterday if his agency would be involved in that conversation as it's related to the EA or the Emergency Alert System, Transportation Safety, and Weather. We'll hear from him, and then as we close out our time together, we'll switch gears just a bit and talk about minorities in agriculture, and we'll do all of that right here on this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, we're here at Washington Watch, and we're joined by the folks at Growth Energy. Joe Kakish is here. He is general counsel for Growth Energy. Tell me what that means you do.
So I am the legal officer of Growth Energy. I work in all areas of the work that we do in the courts and in front of the agencies. I'm an environmental attorney by training, and I also just do general legal work, as the name implies, managing our organization.
What are the issues you see, and I think there'll be a couple of them this year, as it's related to the RFS, what U.S. EPA has been or has already announced, and the June numbers that are yet to come out?
Well, so as you may know, Growth Energy has a consent decree with EPA that requires EPA to finalize the set rule for the 23 to 2025 RVOs by June 14th of this year. What just came out today, however, was a settlement agreement proposal with an environmental group regarding the earlier RVOs for 2020 to 2022 under the Endangered Species Act. So right now we're kind of in a complicated place where there are a number of different timeframes at play, but our goal is always to ensure that EPA completes the rule by the time that it's committed to do it. And so we're really focused on June 14th. To ensure that our members have an ability to plan for the remainder of 2023 and for the 2024 and 2025. Those deadlines are really central to our members to ensure that they can really do their businesses, and with the RFS being in place with the right messages at the right time.
So quick background on the RFS, if you're listening. It does not actually say that ethanol has to be used in the gasoline supply. It does not even say how much ethanol would need to be used in the gasoline supply, other than it can't be, at this point, more than 10%, or 10% of the gasoline supply, or 15 billion gallons. And you stop me there just for a second, because there is one other thing.
Well, no, the RFS actually does not place a 10% cap on conventional ethanol being part of our nation's fuel supply. That is sort of something that's been in place by other groups and industries, implying that there's some limitation, either as a regulatory matter or a practical matter. That is not the case. Secondly, the 15 billion gallon number is also no longer part of the RFS. We are in a new era starting in 2023 where EPA assesses volumetric standards by reference to six statutory factors. So we're moving, 2022 was the last year where EPA started with a statutory 15 billion gallons, and now we're moving to a new era where it has to look at a bunch of factors to come up with the numbers that it came up with for 2023 through 2025.
So interesting enough, this sounds like a dangerous area to be in, because if EPA can be pushed to use more or pushed to use a whole lot less, I was of a mind that they probably would just simply be looking at the advanced biofuel portion and back figuring to that 15 billion gallon number that they had been using for the last several years, since 2015, in fact. No longer the case, apparently.
That's right. So you'll see starting in 2024 that EPA actually goes above 15 billion gallons. in what we're calling the implied conventional. So you're right, EPA does not specifically set conventional biofuel gallons as part of the RFS. It has total, advanced, and cellulosic. And so the what remains from that advanced category is called the implied conventional.
Yeah, that's at 15.5 billion gallons, or the number they've seen, but that's taking in account 250 million gallons for two previous years where those numbers weren't made, right?
Just for 2023. So 2022 was the first 250 million gallons that took into consideration a remand from a lawsuit from 6 years ago. 2023 was the second half of that. But 2024 actually exceeds 15 billion gallons as a matter of the EPA's ordinary assessment of the market. It has nothing to do with supplementing to account for that lawsuit. So this is a positive development where EPA has recognized that there needs to be room for growth in the implied conventional pool and the RFS going forward.
You also mentioned that the 10% is not in play. What does that mean?
So right now, our fuel supply has, as a matter of market penetration, centered around E10 or 10% ethanol being in our gasoline as the standard fuel. But that's not a function of the RFS requiring it to be any more or less than 10%. All model year 2001 and later cars are certified by EPA as being able to use E15. The RFS does not conflict with that any way whatsoever. What you see then, when you have a volumetric standard in the RFS of 15 billion gallons or 15 billion more, that gets translated into a percent standard for obligated refineries. So what the RFS really regulates is what percentage of renewable fuel obligated refineries have to blend. And how that gets translated into the consumer fuel supply is a different question.
So Growth Energy, what do you focus on? Do you focus on moving above 10% in the regular gasoline supply or other things?
So our goal is always to make sure that congressional intent to maximize biofuels each year is met. And how does that happen? By assessing environmental factors, energy security, rural economic development. In our view, all of those factors point toward increasing renewable fuel volumes. Call it volumes, call it percentage standard, but the underlying theme is Congress well understood, starting back in 2005 and again in 2007, that a key climate action for our society is to increase biofuels usage indefinitely. That's why in 2023, Congress said, we can't predict the future forever. We're going to hand it over to EPA to judge what gallons need to be in place, but it has to continue that underlying policy goal of advancing biofuel gallons.
How does this play in an electrified automobile industry world over the next decade, maybe longer?
Well, you know, we've always stated that consumers and manufacturers need to have the broadest degree of flexibility for this energy transition. And that means taking advantage of biofuels benefits today and into the future. And any strategy that leapfrogs or forces technological choices artificially or too early is not something we would endorse. Our view is that biofuels can contribute significantly starting in the model year 2023 and beyond in ways that perhaps electric vehicles aren't yet ready to do. And we want to be partnered with EPA and the administration to make sure that they understand that they don't want to leave carbon reductions on the table by simply choosing a technology prematurely or by neglecting the benefits that biofuels continue to provide. So our advocacy is really centered around that. There's a role for both of these technologies to play for the next decade and beyond.
So you're actually going back to the beginnings of the RFS in 2005 when environmentalists reached across the aisle with agriculture and said, this is a fuel we can look forward to using in the future because we, in their and your opinion, believe that it is good for the environment to use a biofuel, and that continues going forward.
Absolutely. I mean, the wisdom under the RFS does not suddenly go away now that we have a greater concentration of electric vehicles. They continue to play a role. Many estimates have said that at least half of new vehicles on the road by 2040 will still be internal combustion engines. And if you don't make a place for that transition between now and 2040, You're reducing the benefits that biofuels can provide to the nation's greenhouse gas footprint. And you're also hobbling an industry that needs continued investment to innovate and grow in light-duty vehicle markets, but also elsewhere. We're also expanding into sustainable aviation fuel, other co-products that can contribute to, you know, the climate solution. So let's not hobble the industry today making technology choices that could get in the way of even greater advancement down the road.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Joe Kakish is the General Counsel for Growth Energy. Now let's continue this conversation just a little bit from Washington Watch. We're joined by Kathy Bergren, as she is with the National Corn Growers Association. What do you do for them?
For NCGA, I work on all of our renewable fuels policy, so all of the advocacy around renewable fuels issues. It's a full-time job.
Yes, I can believe that. We just heard from Joe Kakish that Growth Energy is actually much more positive about what US EPA has been up to with RVOs on the idea that $15 billion isn't $15 billion and that 10% isn't 10%, and there's a lot of room left now to open this up and be higher blends and higher usage. What do you say to this?
You know, I think certainly, I mean, if we're talking about the renewable fuel standard and the volumes that EPA is working on for the next 3 years, and they're doing things differently, they're setting 3 years at a time. For ethanol, I think we do feel like they landed in a pretty good place in that proposal that we would like them to finalize. The 15 billion gallons, like you said, and there is some small growth in the years after that. So I think just that having that opportunity for some growth is positive. Can we do more? Absolutely. But I think in terms of, you know, where EPA was at with that proposal, we do feel like that was positive for the RFS for the next 3 years.
What do you see is the future for ethanol here in the United States and other parts of the planet?
You know, I think here in the United States, I think really what we have been focusing on with NCGA and working with our partners like Growth Energy and others is how do we remove some of these barriers to moving to higher blends of ethanol? Because certainly if, you know, regardless of what we might think about the rate of adoption of EVs, and there's a lot of different estimates, you think the opportunity for biofuels is to become a bigger share of that fuel gallon. That's where, you know, that's where we can kind of hopefully maintain that source of demand for corn growers. But also, if we're talking about how do we clean up liquid fuels and make those more competitive and relevant and affordable in the long term, blending more biofuels in with that and using more ethanol is a solution.
E15 is one solution potentially, but that requires a different pump, generally speaking, I think. Maybe you can correct me on that. E12 seems like it's easier potentially to get to, because I'm not certain, but that could simply just be blended in the splash way that E10 is at the moment, and most vehicles still can use it.
You know, I think any vehicle right now that is 2001 or newer can use E15. That's almost every vehicle on the road. There's not a lot of people driving a vehicle that's older than a 2001. So I think in terms of that, in terms of vehicles, those vehicles can use that fuel. Infrastructure on the pump side, certainly retailers have invested a lot of money. The standard for new pumps today is compatibility with 25% ethanol for a lot of new pumps. So I think some of these, you know, on the infrastructure side, given the investments that have been made, there's been a lot of progress. I'm not going to say that that's not a concern, but I think we've moved a long way. Certainly the investments that USDA has made in biofuels infrastructure, investments that corn growers, you know, their own money have put into these programs, we've come a long way on the infrastructure. It just seems like that should be less and less of a concern. Folks that raised that, I maybe question a little bit.
Tell me about aviation fuel and the potential in that marketplace.
You know, it's certainly something that we've been spending some time in. A lot of our members are really interested in learning more about what the potential is there. I think we're right now we're making a few drops of sustainable aviation fuel, but you see a lot of commitments from airlines. you know, that they want to purchase that fuel in the future, incentives from the federal government. So I think we do see some opportunity there. And, you know, given that, you know, source of demand, you know, an opportunity for agriculture feedstocks to supply those fuels. Got to get some of the policy right and some of the details right. Those are going to matter. But certainly if there's, you know, this move, and it's going to be a slow move, but we want to make sure we kind of get the policy right on the front end so that there's an opportunity there for agriculture-based feedstocks to supply those fuels.
What does that mean?
You know, mostly there is a new federal tax incentive for sustainable aviation fuel that is being implemented. So I think it's really important that Treasury implements that correctly. That's something that we've, on the policy side, we've focused a lot of attention on, the way that they're going to measure, does that fuel reduce emissions by a certain amount? And how do you, what's the measuring stick that you use? It makes a lot of difference what measuring stick you use. And so I think we're really interested in making sure they use the best domestic model, which we believe the Department of Energy has. And that really helps, you know, make sure that fuels made from an ag-based feedstock, whether that's corn, whether that's vegetable oils or other ag feedstocks, are going to meet the test. You want to be, you know, you don't want to be disqualified before you even get out of the gate.
When you think about consumption going forward of corn, do you suppose that corn going into biofuel can maintain its percentage of total? So at going forward, is that possible, or do we have to make room for new and different uses?
Well, I mean, I think we are, you know, through NCGA and other partners, looking at what are other new uses, because you don't ever want to just, you know, be focused in some areas. But and certainly the livestock market and the biofuels market continue to be the two biggest markets. The way to kind of maintain that demand in the biofuel space is growing that space in each gallon, and making sure, you know, that as these new biofuel opportunities come online on aviation fuel or others, that there is an ability for corn to be part of that game.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you.
Kathy Bergren is with NCGA, the National Corn Growers Association. Listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. Find us online at willag.org, willag.org, or look us up in your favorite podcast application. Well, yesterday here in Washington, D.C., I asked U.S. Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg during a press conference if he would be involved in the AM radio in the automobile dashboard issue as it pertains to EAS and transportation safety. The Secretary of Transportation is involved in safety issues related to transportation. In this case, electric vehicles have caused manufacturers, because of the interference with the AM radio signal, to pull AM antennas and radios in particular out of their automobiles. There have been announcements, particularly from Ford in the recent weeks, as it related to their combustion engine vehicles, that they will no longer carry AM radio in those vehicles in the future as well. I wanted to know if the Department of Transportation thought that this would be a weather-related safety issue.
We certainly recognize the importance and the important role that AM radio has played and continues to play with regard to people getting information that they need for safety, notably but not only when it comes to weather emergencies. And one thing we know about living in these times is that weather emergencies are becoming more frequent and more severe. So while I don't know of a formal legal role that we have with regard to that, it's certainly something that will be on our mind as we remain in dialogue with the auto industry and with related industries when it comes to transportation.
That was U.S. Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg responding to a question related to the future of AM radio's continued existence in automobile dashboards as a safety issue. Again, I'm in Washington, D.C. this week with NAFB, where a representative from Syngenta offered the company's support to the association. As it happened, she went to an ag college, and like here at the University of Illinois, it had all kinds of organizations to join, including, as you'll hear, one that helps minority students in agriculture, Network.
Perfect. Well, my name is Jasmine Scott. I'm the Government and Sustainability Affairs Lead at Syngenta. I'm an Aggie, so I graduated from North Carolina A&T State University, received my master's degree from Virginia Tech, and I'm still at Virginia Tech working while on my PhD. MANRS is short for Minorities in Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Related Sciences. It's a premier organization for minorities studying agriculture, for professionals in this field, and just overall a great organization that is really supporting diversity in our field.
How important was it for you when you were in college and after college to be involved in MANRS, and how involved were you?
I was involved in a lot of different levels. Number one, as a member, and then eventually in my graduate career, I transitioned into my term as a national officer, and that was a really unique experience. So MANRS, through the organization, I received a number of experiences that I helped prepare me for a career in agriculture, and more specifically succeeding at Syngenta. So for example, just receiving public speaking experience, really gaining access to private industry like Syngenta and other companies working to increase diversity in this space, just really having that access, especially as a national officer, really increased my visibility and access to those opportunities, being able to refine my skills and develop talent in within a region. I was the graduate vice president over Region 1, and so I had a jurisdiction, and we worked together to provide programming and support for members within the organization. It was a really great and unique experience.
It's very interesting. It's much like collegiate FFA, relatively speaking. Mm-hmm. It's leadership development that puts you in touch with folks that are within the industry, opens a network to you that maybe you wouldn't have access to.
Again, I would reference a number of different touch points. For example, I know that since I joined, they have recently expanded their junior MANRS division and really tapping into students at the high school level. So that's something that was I was involved with really briefly in helping them with that expansion. And there's really something for everyone in MANRS.
For those who are minorities that are thinking about going into agriculture, would you suggest they do so?
Highly suggest. I can't reinforce that enough. MANRS was really a crucial part of my development, and I would highly recommend it to anyone who is looking to find a community, and anyone looking to support others who are working to increase diversity in agriculture. It's truly needed, and I'm happy to partner with Syngenta in doing that.
Jasmine Scott is with Syngenta, a PhD student, and was heavily involved with MANRS, or Minorities in Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Related Sciences, during her collegiate career. There is a MANRS chapter right here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. You may find us online and listen to us on demand anytime you'd like at willag.org. The theme music for the Closing Market Report is written, performed, and produced by Logan County farmer Tim Gleason. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.